the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. I'm here with Brooke Medina. Our special guest today is Michael Harden. He's the Director of Agricultural Studies and Outreach. Still a fairly new hire at Civitas. Michael, Brooke, how's it going today?
Going great.
It's going well. Very, very glad to be here with you guys discussing all the things. Michael, welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Brooke, and Ray as well. I'm happy to be here and pretty jazzed to be on this great podcast with you guys. Y'all do a great job and hope that I can add to the discussion. Thanks again.
Thank you, Michael. Well, we are very, very glad to have you here at Civitas, and we're going to talk more about what you are doing at Civitas and some of the plans that we have going into this year and next year. But first, I really wanted us to talk about the first important things, which namely our quarantine snacks and just food in general. And so I wanted to ask you all, during this quarantine, have you had go-to snacks?
So I'll go first. I'm a carnivore, so anything meat. But a little side note, we have a small farm and try to raise a lot of what we eat. And I have become fascinated with not only bacon, but different recipes for curing bacon, smoking bacon, and whatnot. So I'm embarrassed to say how much bacon I've consumed this calendar year, and COVID didn't help. But probably here in the
Don't
next week
or two.
Yeah, probably soon I'll be switching to iceberg lettuce and rice cakes to try to equalize my life out. So, but yeah, it's bacon all the way.
Oh my goodness, I love bacon. And to have access to bacon in the way that you have access to bacon, being a farmer like that, that just sounds heavenly. So,
Good stuff.
I've mostly just been like kale, arugula, spinach.
Juicy, really?
Juicing a ton of greens. That's totally
you're so good, Ray.
I know I am. I don't like to, you know, it just hurts me to be kind of talk to the unwashed masses who are like eating meat and sugar. I mean, I know sugar for you is like a staple. So,
oh, I just had Skittles before we started recording.
I mean, anybody sees me, because they can't see me on this podcast, but if they did, they would know I was like peak fitness and just overall like a Greek goddess. God, goddess.
Ray has painted a very accurate picture of himself for you all. So I just encourage you to find him on Twitter or Facebook and ask him to send you photos.
Now they're going to think, I'm like morbidly obese, you know, Pelosi said about Trump this week, calling him morbidly obese.
Oh, that was brutal.
That was pretty brutal.
Yeah, that was crazy. Well, I mean, the reason I wanted to start off with talking about food, well, namely because I love talking about food and eating is just so much fun, and we're going to be doing it in heaven anyways. So I feel like it's a very, very virtuous activity. But also because agriculture is the leading industry here in North Carolina. And so before we delve into that, I do need to say my favorite quarantine snack, though, has been this Talenti gelato. Have you guys ever had that?
No.
That sounds like super fancy. I've not had
that. Oh, it's so fancy. It's so fancy that I only get it for myself and not the rest of my family. And I hide it in my freezer. Because we have one in the garage, but it is amazing. So there's this coffee flavored gelato with this layer of fudge and then chocolate chips and then a vanilla layer under it. It's so good. So anyways, that's my favorite quarantine snack. But Michael, we are here to talk about agriculture. And so we wanted to have you sort of kind of just give us the lay of the land and our audience the lay of the land as to your background in agriculture. I know you mentioned you have a farm. But can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. So I first fell in love with farming as a kid in Robbinsville, North Carolina. So over on the Tennessee line, I had an uncle that farmed and grew tobacco and livestock and really anything that he could grow and make a living off of. So I fell in love with that and today. I do a little farming with my family. We raise draft horses and just about everything else, bees, cows, pigs, chickens, the works. But really, I just, you know, the same thing attracted me to agriculture that attracts so many. I love people and I love growing things. I love the seasons. Fast forward to a few years back, I served in the Georgia legislature, serving on the agriculture committee. So became familiar with a little bit more of the inner workings of government and honestly, a lot of what government can do wrong that interferes with day-to-day farming operations and impacts family farms. So have never really lost that passion. Love to do it, love to talk about it, love to work in that, and really love to be around farmers, producers of all kinds. So again, thank y'all for having me, and really, really looking forward to this conversation.
Michael, let me ask you a question. Why does the tobacco in Kentucky smell so good?
Probably the same reason that bacon does, in that it's not, you know, it's maybe not the best thing for you, although my philosophy is everything in moderation, right? Or a lot of things in moderation, maybe not everything, but, you know, it's like bacon. That's my downside, my downfall. So, I don't know. I don't know that I could tell the difference in Kentucky and North Carolina.
So someone said it was like a little bit different leaf, but when I was living in Kentucky, they hang out, you know, central Kentucky where the horse farms are, they'll hang out the tobacco in the barns and you could smell it kind of early yeah. fall, I guess late summer. And it's one of the best smells, in my opinion, that you'll find in America.
I can concur with that. I a lot of North Carolina, and particularly Western North Carolina, was burley tobacco, whereas, you know, a lot of the flatland, and I'm no tobacco expert, but my understanding is that it's the flue cured. So I grew up spending those evenings and weekends in the tobacco barn grading tobacco and getting it off to market around, you know, Thanksgiving and that, you know, season. So I can definitely understand and relate. I'm with you.
Well, I am not familiar with the smell of Kentucky tobacco, so I don't think I can contribute to this, but I'm going to have to go sniff it sometime.
It might be what you're smelling, Ray.
Yeah, it might be like a scratch and sniff sticker you can get, Brooke. It's really good, though. I mean, I used to drive around Kentucky and roll down my windows near some of these tobacco farms. It just smelt so good. I mean, it's a different smell than North Carolina tobacco. I'm not an expert either. I've been to a few tobacco farms, but, you know, I'm not an expert at all. But just for me, like the tobacco plant in central Kentucky smells so much different than North Carolina. Not to say it's better. It just smells so much better.
Yeah, you're in dangerous territory there. I don't even know the difference, but I'm going to say for the sake of the podcast that North Carolina tobacco is better.
Yes, let's say that so that we don't lose donors here, Ray. No, but Michael, you know, thinking about just how everything and practically every industry has been upended during this time, I wanted to know what your thoughts were on how agriculture in particular is dealing with the coronavirus crisis and, you know, what sort of things are on your radar in terms of the General Assembly and how they can maybe properly address some of the problems going on and then maybe stay out of the way in some of the other areas. So I wanted to just get some of your general thoughts on that first.
Yeah, great question. You know, agriculture is one of those things that at the end of the day, so many Americans and frankly, so many people around the world, but particularly in the United States, it's really easy to lose touch with agriculture and what it takes to put food and fiber on the table and, you know, on our backs, frankly. And it takes oftentimes situations like this for us all to really see what goes into it. And unfortunately, see some of the downsides of years and years of government intervention that have made the food system fragile, not because COVID has necessarily affected the way that plants grow or that animals grow, but we're seeing it with, you know, meatpacking plants that have become so centralized with, you know, literally you could count on one hand the number of major meatpacking companies in the country. You know, there's, like a lot of things in society, there's benefits to progress, but there's also a lot of downsides. And when it comes to food and something as basic as making sure that our family and our children have enough to eat, we've got to make sure that, we're looking at that in the most responsible way. And, you know, it's not that a lot of these farms and farmers aren't wanting to do it differently. It's that government and influences in state capitals and Washington, D.C. have really made it tough for the little guy to get shelf space and to play in the market. And so that's the primary reason that Civitas has gotten into this space for too long. You know, center right and frankly, center left. A lot of folks have left the agriculture subject alone and focused on the things that we all feel very passionately about, you know, social issues and taxes and education and infrastructure and economic development. But it's well past time that we got involved in agriculture for the sake of making sure that, you know, the next COVID-19 or something bigger, heaven forbid, that although we could be debating a lot of things and their stability, food and food production is not going to be one of them.
This is a little bit of a pivot, Michael, but, you know, I guess when Bloomberg was running for president, that clip came out where he said you could teach anybody to be a farmer. And I don't want to pick on Bloomberg so much, but I do want to get at this point of, you know, obviously there's a lot of urbanization going on the last few generations. People want to live in cities, and I get that. But how is there a disconnect maybe with agricultural policy, and how does that show up maybe in some of our policies? Because people don't really understand farming. I mean, it's changed in many ways. It's some things are the same, but there's been a lot of changes. There's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of technology involved. But why is it important maybe for your average person in the city who never really had a rural existence or really had any kind of farming experience? Why is it important that they know something about farm policy and agricultural policy?
No, that's a great question, Ray. And it's one that, you know, we've really turned on its head in the last 30 or 40 years. I mean, when you look at the world through time, I mean, it's only in the last 100 years that food production has become what it has in the last 100 years. I mean, my grandparents, you know, they grew up in a time where if there was a house, there was a milk cow. And everyone had, you know, some chickens to feed the table scraps to, and everyone had a little garden, you know, as recently as World War II with the market gardens. I mean, everyone had the basic staples, and if they needed to go to the store, they were getting things that they couldn't grow. And so the, you know, post-World War II era, really brought in not only streamlining a lot of industries, and a lot of things that have been incredibly beneficial to not only our ways of life, but, you know, our life expectancy, et cetera. But it's also had its downsides. And one of the exciting things and one of the really interesting things is that we're starting to see this rebirth of urban agriculture. I mean, you can go on YouTube today and just type in urban agriculture or urban farming, and you've got a litany of folks that are, you know, in these downtown areas of, you know, Detroit and Charlotte, that are taking abandoned lots that used to have a house on it, and they're growing vegetables for their community. And so I think a lot of times we're seeing that, you know, there's the folks in the urban areas that frankly tend to be a little more left-leaning, are sometimes ahead of us on food policy and agriculture policy as far as having a better understanding of, you know, the overburdensome regulations and government interventions. So it is, it's definitely in a transition period. I think that everything that's going on today is highlighting some of those vulnerabilities. When you start hearing of these huge farms that are, you know, having to euthanize their animals and stuff because they can't get them to market. So, you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of different ways to raise, you know, you take any segment of agriculture, hogs, chickens, potatoes, there's a whole litany of ways to do it. There's organic, there's non-GMO, there's cage-free, there's free-range. I mean, I could list 36 more. And my opinion on the matter is, although I have my personal opinions, is that what we need to do is to make sure that everyone has the same access to the market and let the consumers decide what they want to eat and what they want to provide for their family. So I know we can get into that, and I don't want to give you too long of an answer, but I think that, you know, I think we're seeing an emergence here, and I'm pretty excited about it. I really think that the pendulum is going to swing back, particularly maybe a little faster in light of recent months, to where we're going to get back to where food's going to be growing a lot closer to the folks that are consuming it. And that for me, and frankly, for the people of North Carolina, I think is a very, very good thing.
So, Michael, on that, kind of bringing things more local again, I've heard some people talk about food justice, and like you mentioned, the center left groups or even maybe far left groups that have taken on agriculture and come at it from that angle. Do you see areas wherein we can collaborate and build these bipartisan coalitions that really, really push back against the notion that that the government needs to prop up maybe bigger agribusinesses and allow smaller businesses to be able to compete on similar footing?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's you know, I've been dealing in this space now for a little over 10 years that this has been a passion of mine. And the thing about agriculture and local food production, unlike any other political issue that I'm aware of, and I can say this from experience, is the fact that this attracts people from both extremes of the political spectrum. You're very conservative, folks on the right, to your very liberal, progressive folks on the left. I mean, the fact that they can't, you know, enter into a contract with their neighbor to, you know, have them butcher chickens for them to put on their table, or to raise a hog without it having to be processed at a certain facility, or to consume, you know, any food of their choice without the government saying that it's okay or not okay, is a very interesting dynamic. And it attracts, like I said, folks from both political spectrums, that I think is something to be very encouraged by, in that now that Civitas is playing in this space, I think we're going to be able to slay a lot of giants, because we're going to be able to work across the aisle with folks from every corner of North Carolina. Again, not to pick winners and losers, as the government and different lobbyists have attempted to do over the years, but at the end of the day, ensure that if someone from Asheville or Raleigh or wherever, if they want to, you know, take a stab at the American dream and try to grow a crop or a food, the government's not at the edge of their yard telling them that they can't, or that they can't take it to market. And so I'm very encouraged by the makeup of the folks that are excited about this. And frankly, I think it's the single thing that's going to help us get this really revamped in North Carolina, is the fact that Democrats, Republicans, urban, rural, religious, non-religious, everyone is coming around to care that, you know, at the end of the day, we can either spend a lot of money in the healthcare industry, or we can spend, you know, money producing good nutrient dense food. And not to say that folks should have to consume one food over the other, but under no circumstance should government tell someone that that there's a certain way of doing it that they don't agree with or concur with. We should leave that to the consumers. And like so many things in this great country, the consumers will tell us what they have an appetite for.
Michael, let me ask you about North Carolina has, since I guess tomorrow officially goes into phase two. Brooke, you can correct me if I'm wrong. All the days run together now. But what are some of the biggest complaints? Because I know you're talking about to farmers in North Carolina and those in the ag sector. What are some of the biggest challenges with the current shutdown towards farmers they're facing? I know every farm is different. Every sector is probably different. But what are some trend lines that you see in terms of challenges in terms of the survivability of some of these farms and how they're optimistic or pessimistic about the future?
Yeah, so I don't know of a more resilient demographic than the American farmer, and particularly the North Carolina farmer. I mean, you look at, you know, how much the North Carolina landscape has changed just over the last 20 years. I mean, I grew up spending my summers topping tobacco outside of Robbinsville, North Carolina. And today, I don't know if there's any, very little tobacco grown there. I mean, you're talking about decades of history and livelihoods and understandings and mastering how to produce that crop better than anyone in the country. But they turned on a dime. And, you know, like my uncle immediately went from tobacco to high tunnel production of vegetables and goat production and different things. And so I think that, you know, farmers, you know, they live with the unknown. It's the weather. It's too much rain. It's not enough rain. It's too cold. It's too early. It's too late. The market's weak, and those types of things. But at the end of the day, through all of that, when the sun does come out, they put more seeds in the ground. And when the calf is struggling in a thunderstorm to survive, they're out there, you know, at midnight taking care of it. And so if there's a group in the country that can sustain, it's the American farmer. But I think that the headwinds they're facing isn't any of that, frankly, as much as it is government telling them what they can do. I mean, if someone in North Carolina wants to raise chickens in a non-traditional way, meaning outside of a confinement chicken house, there's a 20,000 bird limit put on them by DC that North Carolina has adopted. Well, you know, you profit in $3 a bird, you know, 20,000 birds over the year, it's hard to sustain, you know, by the time you factor your costs and all those sort of things. And so, you know, there's so many of those things that, frankly, if they're dangerous, they should be illegal. And I don't know any other product in the country where the government says this is an unbelievably dangerous product, so we're going to limit its, you know, and you can only consume it in moderation. But we do that with raw milk. We do that with chicken. You know, we've put ourselves in a position to where if I want to butcher some cattle, I can be a cattle farmer. And, you know, rather than take them to the sale barn and then they're put on a tractor trailer and sent to Nebraska to be fed out on corn at a feedlot, which, you know, that is what it is. That's fine. There's a market for that. But the reason so many farmers are having to do that is because it's so burdensome to find a USDA federal inspected facility to be able to slaughter in order to sell across state lines or to sell commercially to a restaurant. And so, you know, the government has put so many of these farmers in a box to saying, okay, you want to grow cattle, you can grow cattle, but you're basically just going to have to live on the market and you're not going to be able to provide it to your neighbors because we're going to put so many roadblocks in front of you that it's going to be easier for you to take it to the barn and sell it wholesale rather than get the full value dollar out of it and taking it all the way retail to the customer. So, you know, I've not talked to one farmer in the last 10 years that has, when I asked them, what's the biggest headwind? I've literally not had one. And I've asked over 100, I know. I've not had one tell me, you know, I just need a little more government. I need a little bit. I need the Department of Agriculture to do A, B, or C. They all say, you know, we risk, you know, we're taking out loans in the spring to put seeds in the ground with the note coming due in October, not even knowing if we're going to get a harvest. It's not that they're afraid of risk. It's that they just want a chance. They plant seeds knowing that the sun's going to come up tomorrow and hoping that it stays up. And government needs to be looking at them the same way and saying, you know, what can we do to get out of their way to ensure that North Carolina farmers, regardless of the economic climate, regardless of international trade and foreign trade, that they can sustain. And the best way to sustain is for North Carolina farmers to be feeding North Carolina folks and families. And if we can do that and diversify their client base, their customer portfolio, then they're going to be in good shape. And we're not going to be having discussions in the future about, you know, farmers hitting a hiccup in the road and possibly having to sell some acreage or put themselves even further into debt to get out of it.
So, Michael, this might require a little bit of nuance and ability to appreciate this nuance. And I'm by no means an agriculture expert, but I'm just curious, listening to you talk and just, you know, hearing your passion for North Carolina farmers being able to actually provide the products and the food to North Carolinians. How would Civitas approach that sort of goal, you know, while respecting consumer demand? And also, I think of it in terms of just the ongoing debate between among those on the right related to protectionism, you know, trying to make sure we're bringing manufacturing back to the U.S., which Civitas has spoken a number of times about our desire for free trade and a preference for that, because that actually lowers prices for us. But how does agriculture fit into the free market and helping North Carolina farmers?
Great, great question, Brooke. One of the easiest ways to talk about this, particularly in light of what we're all going through, is the trade-off, right? You look at Governor Cooper and the fact that North Carolina businesses continue to be crippled, under the quote-unquote safety and health. And that's the same mantra that's been put out there from an agriculture perspective for, you know, the last 50 or 60 years, is that so many of these regulations are there because of the health and safety of the consumer. Even though in certain doses, we acknowledge that all of that is okay. I mean, it's okay to raise 20,000 chickens to sell if they're free range, but it's not okay to sell 20,001, which is weird. I'm not familiar with any other product where, there's a cutoff. In North Carolina, you have if Ray, being the Greek god that he is, decided he wanted to be a dairy farmer, he could have 10 cows and he can't sell that raw milk, you know, drop his tailgate at the farmer's market and sell that milk, which has been consumed by people for, you know, since the beginning of time, unpasteurized milk. That's only a phenomenon that's happened in the last 100 years, because of some poor practices, in your major cities back at the turn of the century. But I say that to say that in North Carolina, that we have a thing called herd shares, to where, Ray can sell raw milk if I buy a share of his cow. So he determines that his cow gives 20 gallons a week. He can find 20 families to buy a share of the cow and they all get a gallon a week. And, I don't know of a meth lab in North Carolina to where it's like, hey, you can't be selling meth. However, if you are part owner in the meth lab, it's okay. So we've done this out of safety. You know, we say that, you know, poultry is a very dangerous thing to consume if it's not prepared properly. So we put this weird limit of 20,000 birds on it. Yet there's nothing that says that, you know, anyone can't go to the supermarket and buy chicken and then just decide to consume it raw. So there's just so many inconsistencies across the board. And it is, when you talk to people, whether they're on the left or the right, and you sort of highlight some of these nuances, they all scratch their heads and say, what? And frankly, the reason that that's been the case is that there's not been a Civitas at the table saying, guys, this doesn't make sense. Instead, what you have is different folks in the market that don't want the competition, that want to limit their competitors, or frankly, just want to justify their existence, who say, oh, we should cap this, or we should put a little, you know, finger on the scales over here. Everyone's got a lobbyist except the taxpayer. And I really see that our role as Civitas is to advocate for the taxpayers.
That's a really good way to put it. Ray, do you have any closing questions?
Absolutely. Michael, let me ask you a question. Have you ever, I'm sure you have, but have you ever stretched and run barbed wire?
Way too much.
That has got to be one of the hardest things I've ever done. It seems like it looks kind of easy, but it's something I was not good at. I worked on a cattle farm for a short time after seminary. It was really one of the hardest jobs I've ever had. And it was like, I couldn't wait to be done with it, even though I'm not a quitter. So I kept with it until I found something else. But I don't know what the trick is to that. Do you have any advice?
No, although I can tell you I'm much more productive if my wife's watching, because I like to show out. So I'm a much better fence builder if she's in the shade watching, because I'm continuing to try to show out for her. But frankly, Ray, there's no easier fun way to do it. It's the biggest motivator besides my wife is the fact that you go to bed at night and you feel pretty good that you've stretched it tight enough to where your cows are on the same side come morning. So that's the trick.
Yeah, I enjoyed watching cows being inseminated more than I did running the barbed wire.
Oh my gosh.
Well, coming from a guy that's ate kale since the beginning of the pandemic, I am finding out everything about Ray that makes me love you even more. So
I think that's just a really good way to end the podcast. You know?
There you go, man. There you go.
I guess so, because I don't want to talk about this no more.
I mean, these are, you got to get your hands dirty, Brooke. I mean, these are things that you have to be exposed to. when you're that's in right. the outdoors and working on the farm. I mean, I wasn't expecting it. He's like, hey, I need you to help me do this. And it was a little traumatic.
Sounds like it. Oh, wow. Well, you know what? I will get my education by watching a Netflix documentary and take y'all's word for it. But this was a great, very, very interesting conversation. So, Michael, thank you so much for joining us this week. We really appreciate it.
Hey, it's been a pleasure not only to join you on the podcast, but to join the Civitas team. And for everyone listening, look for big things to come from Civitas in the form of agriculture, like every issue. And I think that as time goes by, North Carolina and both the farmers and the consumers are going to be better because we've got some really smart people involved, like Brooke and Ray. And I can't wait to start slinging rocks at these giants with you guys. So thank y'all for having me. Thank you for having me on your team. And if anyone out there needs to reach me through Civitas website, et cetera, happy to help anyone anytime. So thank y'all.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael and Brooke. You can read all of our content, nccivitas.org.